Welcome to BizRocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for BizRocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Good morning and welcome to BizRocket Radio. We're here for another show interviewing and talking to executives and business owners here in the Atlanta area. We actually have a special show today. We have three guests in, and all of them having a vast experience in working in an operating business in China. And really, we're going to have this more of a panel discussion than individual one-on-ones, and definitely look forward to it. Some of the questions that we have prepared, I'm definitely interested in learning a lot more about how things really work in China. So I'm just going to start off and go through a bit of an introduction, or have them go through an introduction, and a little bit of a background on who they are, kind of how they got to where they are now. And then we'll dive straight into the question. So our first guest is Chris Wustrow. Is that right, Chris?
That's right, Chris Wustrow.
All right, pretty close. And Chris, maybe you could give us a little bit of a background on our team in China Consulting, which you're the director of, right?
That's right. I started my own firm about 2.5 years ago, our team in China Consulting. And basically we help the small and medium-sized American companies with marketing in China, whether they have a product that they wish to market in China, or the opposite, if they wish to source product in China. So, for example, we also help universities try to gain brand recognition in China, and also investment opportunities in the U.S., whereby Chinese citizens can become citizens through an investment program of the State Department. And we also help to promote those programs.
Okay, great. And our next guest is Craig Belknap. And Craig is has been an executive with Alcoa for many years, just transitioning from that and kind of getting into the next phase of his career. But he has all sorts of great stories in China. Maybe, Craig, you could tell us a little bit about your background.
I'm an engineer by training with an MBA, and I've spent the last 17 years with Alcoa as an executive. 8 of those years I was actually living in China, 4 in Shanghai, 4 in Beijing. The 4 in Shanghai, I was running operations for Alcoa, and the 4 in Beijing, I was the VP of Human Resources for Asia. So that included everything from setting up the HR systems to managing the compliance lines to helping with government relations and so forth.
Great. Good stuff. Well, welcome in.
Thank you.
Next, we've got John Corbett, who is the president of Corbett and Associates. John's actually been on our show in the past, and we wrangled him in once again for our China show. Welcome in, John. Maybe a little bit of background on you.
Yeah, thank you, John. I'm glad to be here again. I've got 30 years of experience in sales, marketing, and engineering. That's both with Fortune 500 companies and executive, and pre-IPO companies, vice president, member of the senior management team. In that 30 years, and part of why I'm here this morning, it includes business in Asia since 1991, which was an interesting side note that I'd mentioned, you know, to you, and being able to contrast the difference that I've seen in business, China specifically, Asia in general since that point in time. So interested in being able to talk about that this morning and learn more from our other guests.
All right. Well, let's get right to it. So the first question that I've got on the top of my mind is corporate culture. So in the United States, we have kind of a certain corporate culture you go into, you expect to live through and deal with. Operating in China, what's different? How is it most different operating business in China? What are some of the faux pas you have in China that you may not have here? What would an executive or somebody who's traveling to China for the first time or trying to operate businesses need to know about corporate culture? We'll start with Craig.
This covers a whole range of items, but a couple of things clarify it. We would talk about the culture of our company in the case of those of us who are working with multinational companies and the culture of companies we would be dealing with. Companies in China typically fall into two categories. There's the state-owned companies that are owned by the cities, by the provinces, by the country, and then there's entrepreneurial companies, and they have very different cultures themselves. So just briefly touching on that, state-owned companies are exactly what we would all think. They're very bloated. They're unproductive. They have political objectives more so than operating objectives. They're very difficult to do business with, and we'll talk more about that later. John and I were sharing stories earlier. Entrepreneurial companies, my experiences, behave very similar to entrepreneurial companies everywhere else in the world, and there are more and more entrepreneurial companies there. They are very very quick, very decisive, very cost-oriented, more so than we would ever be. But in almost all cases, the Chinese companies that I've dealt with are very structured, very top-down.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment as well. obviously, the big difference between the SOEs, state-owned enterprises, and the private ones. However, when you get outside of, at least in my experience, outside of the major cities like Shanghai or Beijing or Guangzhou, and you get more into more traditional areas, you still, even in private enterprises, you still have a lot of the old Chinese traditions. One example would be Chinese owners love to have what's called face or mianzi, and one way of getting face is to have lots of employees, because if you have lots of employees, you're sort of like your own king in your own kingdom.
Get your own thing going on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that may be counter to a cost reduction objective, but to them, mianzi or face is far more important. Again, not so much in Shanghai, but more in the West.
And they would build a huge, massive office building where we would all rent one or two small offices.
That's the same reason. So you would have extravagance on buildings, on the location, again personnel, certainly foreign trips if they can finagle that in. It's more like the U.S. back, I guess, in the '60s or so with that way.
It seems like there's also a lot generated around. Even if you are a private organization, there's a bit of the public or the public sector, the government is in your business a good bit, knowing the local kind of government employees or government representatives is almost more important there than it is here. What do you guys think about that?
Well, yes, the concept of relationships or guanxi is extremely important, and basically the relationships of who you know and what that person can do for you. And yes, it's true of government. So if you have a regulator that comes by or a health inspector or fire brigade chief or any number of capacities could shut you down. So basically you have these guanxi brokers who you hire, and they're sort of third party, and they take care of that, quote unquote.
Sounds like a lobbyist to me.
Right. It would be a lobbyist off the books, I guess.
Many of my experiences aren't necessarily hired, although you can certainly hire them. By establishing a business and running it over many years, you've done a number of favors, and favors are all reciprocal, and so you've created this guanxi with everyone else. And there is no problem in China that is not solvable through guanxi. And especially for the foreign person, it may be guanxi that's preventing the solution of some problem that seems very obvious to you. And so until you understand how all the relationships are working,
right,
you really don't know how to solve these problems. Now, I would, one disclaimer here, that is much, much bigger outside of Shanghai and Shenzhen. The very, I hate to use the word, progressive modern areas, they're getting more and more protective of the entrepreneurs. And so the political relationship is always important, but it's not vital as it would be in smaller towns. In smaller towns, the biggest business owner might as well be the mayor.
Interesting thing about Guangxi, I think it also speaks to the fact that people from the West shouldn't expect to do business quickly in Asia, and China would be a good example. And why is that? This Guangxi, or that building and establishing the relationship, takes time. And as Craig mentioned, it's extremely reciprocal. And he also mentioned that it could work against you, and because it's reciprocal, it takes time to build that cache, if you will, of goodwill. Another one of the things that that I experience, the Guangxi is sometimes self-serving for the Chinese because they want to do things and help you, but at the same time, they've got to know what they're going to get for it. They're also very title-oriented. So we've actually had a situation where we've had to give people, put the word senior in front of their name to help them be able to get access to higher level individuals, because those people that wanted to build that Guangxi didn't want to do it with a more junior level person.
But I think it is important to note too that as Craig was saying, that it is changing to some degree, especially as the Chinese business leaders become more astute, and in fact, again, the main objective is to make money. Profit is the main objective. So that if you can show them a compelling reason why this product or this solution or this service is a moneymaker, you can convince them over time even to break through some of the Guangxi barriers. That, I notice, is changing in some of the Tier 1 cities.
What about the business ownership piece? Craig, maybe you could talk to if you're a foreigner going into China, how do you own a business there?
One thing we should make clear is that we actually, for most businesses, you couldn't own them, or you had to have a joint venture partner up until about 5 years ago, and there are some industries that are still protected. Now, that changed in about 2004, 2005, and there's a number of industries where it can be completely wholly foreign-owned. You can go set up your own business, and that has really made it much easier. Now, I will say, you should probably not be an absentee owner unless your brother-in-law is running the business over there. You really need to have a close connection to your businesses in China. One of the things that I was going to comment on, I think it's important to notice, is culturally for hundreds and thousands of years, China has been very much about image and appearance, since it goes a lot to the face point that Chris was mentioning. And because of that, many people have been trained for years that even data or surrounding business is all about image, and so the accuracy of the data is very suspect, and you'll find this all over the place. And you would never, ever take data that you get from China if you can't put your hands on it. So if someone says they have $2 million worth of assets, you better be able to put your finger on the $2 million worth of assets. I'll share a funny story later in the show.
I love stories.
All right, I apologize, Chris and John, but I was running a factory in Shanghai, and our quality wasn't up to snuff, and it was going on for weeks after weeks, and I finally was very frustrated. I speak Chinese, so I managed in Chinese, and I had said, this number is unacceptable. We have got to have a higher quality level here.
Okay, say that in Chinese.
Let's see, how would I have said that? Well, this表现是根本不可以接受的，我们的客户肯定会告我们.
There you go, okay. Official.
So,
like that.
Yeah. So the numbers were unacceptably low in the quality level. 1 week later, so I have the staff meeting every week. The next week, after 6 weeks of low numbers, magically, it's fantastic. And I, of course, know that it didn't magically get that fantastic. So I'm like, I'm trying to explore this in a way where I'm not assaulting this person's face in front of everybody, but I'm trying to, wow, that's terrific. You know, help me to understand this. And so I'm sort of slowly peeling this back. And in the end, it comes out that, well, there was one quality defect that we went back to our definition and realized technically it didn't qualify under that definition, so we took it out. And so really, their understanding was, I was looking for a better number, not for better quality.
Right.
And you really have to connect those and say, no, the number is an indication of a performance, and you're really looking for that performance. And you'll see this everywhere in China. This is also changing, but it's historical. For hundreds of years, we saw it in the Cultural Revolution. We saw it under the emperors. We've seen it forever.
Yeah. What do you see as work culture here and there. I mean, if I'm working at IBM or AT&T here in Atlanta, and I'm going into work every day, and I'm working X amount of hours and X amount of weeks, and how is that different with work culture in China?
Autocratic, very much autocratic. As a matter of fact, I've worked for Chinese companies, and of course, seen Chinese companies in the U.S., and it extends even to the U.S. as well. I think that one of the things that I walked away with is the sense of the subservience of the people and the autocratic nature of the leader. Another thing that's fairly unique, you wouldn't see it in Japan, but you'll see it in China, and that is women in senior management positions. And the women seem to be the most autocratic. And the workers are literally scared almost. And so you see head down, eyes down, when that senior executive is present. So one of the things that I walked away with is it's just very, very subservient nature of the workers in general in most of the companies.
Especially they're scared of those HR chiefs in Shanghai who are always Shanghai women.
Yeah.
And it no matter what firm it is, Western, German, I mean, Japanese, they're always hiring these Shanghai HR chiefs, and they are scary.
They bring down a heavy stick, huh?
Yes.
I'd like to comment a little bit on that internal culture. It is very top-down, very autocratic, and because of that, those of us who are managing businesses or as people, listeners who may be trying to work with businesses, there's not a lot of individual initiative initially. You would really have to train that into people, and as an operator of a company over there, we were able to develop that, but if you just started there, you would find people waiting to be instructed what to do, which, by the way, is one of the reasons they can turn large companies actually quite quickly. In the U.S., where we might gather us all together and try and get consensus, we don't have to get consensus.
No
there.
Unions, huh?
Right.
Not a lot of
yeah.
unions
and,
going
well,
on.
Well, there are unions, okay. But we can talk about that a little bit later, too. But they don't have to get consensus. They make a decision, and the whole organization, you know, salutes, and off they go. But when you're looking for a consensus solution, a team solved solution, or you're looking for individual initiative to solve problems you never even knew existed, that's you got to train that.
The initiative issue is a major factor, as Craig was saying. I mean, my experience is not with the big firms like Alcoa or, you know, the big firms. My experience is, unfortunately, with the smaller firms. That just happened to be where my life ended up. But nonetheless, you're right. You have to literally take them under your wing, you know, give them the expectations, exactly what you need. A lot of hand-holding has been my experience in training, from anyone from the secretary to someone who's managing a program or a project for you. And then on a larger scale, there's a huge opportunity for management and leadership training in China. Again, that's something I'm working on, and externally is to try to introduce an online on-demand platform for companies for that in a bilingual format, just because all of Asia and Southeast Asia, again, it comes back to this issue of initiative training, time management, things that we take for granted a little bit here are just absent in many cases there.
As a sales executive, whether it's a national that you're hiring in a sales position or whether it's working with the indirect sales channel, that issue of initiative is not going to be the same that you would expect from a U.S. person. So there are level settings that you have to do that are different. So as Chris pointed out, the kinds of training, the kinds of expectations, the kinds of directions that you'll generally need to provide them need to be much more specific and much more detailed than you might be used to giving to a direct employee, you know, in a U.S. company.
What about negotiating contracts, negotiating businesses? It seems like that is I got six rolling eyes here in the studio. Tell me a little bit about negotiations with the Chinese. Right now he's choking literally.
They love to negotiate. As a matter of fact, I mean, you can go to the different bazaars and the shops, and if you just offer them whatever the price is, they'd be a little bit surprised. Although probably not from a Westerner, but negotiations in China, and they've done it all over the world, are some of the most difficult. And it's not just because of the competitive nature and the low cost, but as an example, a lot of American companies will have a price book, and that price book will be U.S. prices, European prices, and prices for Asia, because the prices for Asia in general just need to be that much lower. Secondarily, if you're working from the U.S. and you're talking to people in Asia, and a lot of people have never done this, but Incoterms and the importance of Incoterms takes on a whole new meaning.
What is an Incoterm?
International, basically, it's international shipping term. So you might order something here, and you would say, let's just say FOB, because that's what most people know. And that would really be inaccurate and from a legal standpoint, because FOB is water transportation only, and it's going to come to your house probably by, you know, land transportation. But anyhow, so over there, not only do they want you to deliver, say, DDU, you know, they're going to want it, and they're going to want you to pay the tariff, they're going to want you to pay the shipping, there's huge incurred costs. But the one of the last ones, over here, for years, a lot of people would start off with payment terms of 30 days. They would laugh in your face. Nobody accepts payment terms of 30 days, you know, in China. They may start at 90, and you'd be lucky to get 60, but I've seen payment terms of 120 days.
My background in negotiations covers mergers and acquisitions and businesses as well. I probably would comment a little bit there. My experience, especially with state-owned enterprises, is they have absolutely no urgency to conclude any deal. And for those of us who value that, you know, think about the time value of money, everyone in the West is trying to get deals done as quickly as we can, because every passing day is a lost opportunity for revenue.
Right? Yeah.
They know that, and they behave very differently. And so time is always on their side. And my experience is in negotiating with those kinds of deals, you really have to make sure you already have in hand what you want before you finalize that deal. And I there's experiences where Alcoa didn't quite have in hand, but believed we had in hand. And sure enough, when the deal was done, it wasn't in hand anymore. And that happens repeatedly. Now, my experience with entrepreneurs is quite the opposite. You do have to get to all the details that John mentioned, but they negotiate the way we do. And Chris sort of mentioned, you know, if they see the opportunity for money, they'll reach a deal.
Yes, I've noticed that as well. However, I do have some other stories, especially in raising capital in China. I had a project where I was assigned to start a business in China. It was in the entertainment sector. So if you are familiar with Dave and Buster's here in Atlanta, it's sort of that concept. It was a bit of a nightclub / entertainment venue for adults with, you know, games and things of that nature. And so we needed a Chinese investor to go in with this project, of course, by law, as a joint venture component, but also because we wanted the Guangxi in that area. And my goodness, it took forever to try to, you know, wine and dine those who had the funds. And and of course, we were showing them an American-style business plan, you know, the glossy book with all of the P&L and the pro forma forecasts, and none of that mattered. None of that mattered. In fact, they had very little concept of basic corporate finance, very little concept of the venture capital idea or entrepreneurial funding or sweat equity was not even a concept they understood. So, you know, if something cost 100 yuan, then if we're 50-50 partners, then it must be 50-50. So, you know, there's no consideration for the upfront sweat equity.
Right.
And it was a concept which was one that was extremely difficult. We finally got them to understand some value of that sweat equity, and we were able to raise money and complete the project, and it became operational. We eventually lost it, but that's another story.
If I can pick up on that point, that's interesting, because the valuation of what businesses contribute as foreign companies, multinationals like Alcoa, created businesses in China, we would buy assets and we would contribute technology or management. And it was the same thing. It was painful. Now China had been burned on some of those as well, where people were claiming to contribute modern technology and lots of things, and they had been overvalued. And there was a sense that the crown jewels, this government-owned property, had now been, you know,
ransacked
by some foreign power, which, if we know history over there, is not a welcome thing. So that's a concern, and you have to understand that. But trying to get them to understand the value of all the contributions is really important.
I've got an interesting story about, you know, China and the government and the kind of steps that they'll take to protect those kinds of revenue streams. A couple years ago, Macau was actually generating more revenue in gambling than Las Vegas, and Chinese love to gamble. And the Chinese government saw that, you know what, we're having a problem being able to get as many foreigners over here. We want them to have a great experience in Macau, but there's too many Chinese at the gambling tables. So they increased the fee for the visa. They reduced not only the frequency, but the length of the time that the Chinese could stay so that there would be basically less, you know, Chinese there and make more room for the foreigners at the gambling tables and in Macau. And I heard this story from a person who said, I used to go there, I don't know, 6 or 8 times a year, and now I can only go 3 or 4. But
gaming the gaming tables.
So, right? Solution fix. Soon as China figured out that Macau is a huge cash cow.
Interesting. So it seems like just the culture, obviously there's a lot of cultural differences. What would you say is some of the biggest cultural differences that you find living in China, working in China versus, say, in the States?
I'll start on that one. I think getting used to the fact that everybody is waiting to be instructed as to how to work and really knowing that a big chunk of your time is invested in developing individual initiative and training. That Chris mentioned that earlier, John did too. That is a huge item. Really devoting the energy and the time to relationships. Here in the West, we go to work and we have some friends at work and maybe we hang out a little bit out of work, but we go home, hang out with our families and maybe our neighbors.
Right. You try there, not to mix it as much.
Right. There, you have to invest a lot of time. You need to know going over, you're going to invest a lot of time in building relationships. One of the things John mentioned that was very interesting is we would have people parachute in from the corporation to help us on mergers and acquisition things, and I would try to help them understand how rude is a little overstatement, but how rude that came off to the Chinese, because they come in one night, they come for a 6-hour, 8-hour meeting, and they get on a plane and leave, and these relationships are built up over weeks and months and years, and they're built up over dinners and lunches and meals and gifts.
Bars, don't forget the bars.
Drinks. And bars. and that is absolutely critical to building success, building the guanxi, understanding how the organization works. And we come in, we show them our glossy brochure, we walk through the numbers and say, hey, let's do a deal. And that kind of abruptness is just very hard to make work in China.
Hmm. Right. I was just going to add to that. I always use the term parachute marketing. Mm-hmm. And this is something where American business owners, this is where they fall into traps. They feel like they can go in for a week into China. They'll even in that week go to multiple cities and think that they're meeting Chinese agents or brokers or whatever, or, you know, counterparts, and they think that they're actually doing good. It's a waste of a trip. And especially when you have city governments, state governments, and then they send those, you know, delegations over of the governor of Michigan or the governor of the, and they do these big dinners. Again, I mean, nice, but it doesn't really get to the anywhere beyond the surface. And this is what Craig was mentioning, that you really have to spend the time, and that's kind of where a firm like mine focuses on, where we have personnel in China, and I go back frequently. And we try to, you know, outsource those relationships management, basically relationship management outsourcing. On a business standpoint inside the office,
yeah.
It's funny because you have actually the employees that are one cultural difference is you walk in and you just see the employees just sitting around on their computers playing what's called QQ, which is their internet chatting. It's like AOL chat used to be here.
Yeah,
and they'll just do it hours and hours at the desk, until they're told something to do. And then the other big cultural difference is, of course, the drinking. It's just the amount, especially for sales. if you are in sales in China, you have to spend hours upon hours drinking, or what's called KTV bars or karaoke bars. This is where you sing. And unfortunately, I hated those places, but. And you had to put in the time to do that. And a lot of American executives that I've noticed, they go and they live in their compounds, these big Western compounds, usually out in Pudong or other areas.
The expat life.
They're completely separate from the real life in China. And their wives even gather for a 1 week, an outing once per week into the city. It's just it's just a complete disconnect with reality.
I have one example that I used to use for the people back in the U.S., as a matter of fact, to try to give them a better idea of this, the Guanji, and I called it dwell time. And they said, well, what is that? I said, imagine a huge, big door on a vault in a bank. If you walked over there and hit it with your fist, it's probably not going to move. But if you push on it with your finger very, very slowly over a period of time, you'll get that door to close. That's how we need to look at doing business in most all of Asia. Chinese isn't, you know, China isn't unique. And then we're like, oh, really? So, you know, to the point that, you know, Chris made, yeah, buying those tickets, I mean, that's an awful lot of money. So you're looking at dropping $10,000 or $12,000 to send somebody over there to buy a ticket to, quote, parachute, you know, marketing. I said, boy, there's a lot of things we could do locally with that money, with training. Spiffs, the indirect distributors, you know, they like those kinds of things. There's many other things we could do that would be much more productive than the, to use Chris's phrase, I like the parachute marketing.
John, if I can make a couple comments.
Yeah.
One of the things that, as Westerners, as Caucasian-looking faces, we have both pluses and minuses in China. If you speak Chinese, and Chris and I both speak Chinese, you sort of know all of the rules. You know what you can get away with and what you can't get away with. In one sense, the Chinese actually are quite tolerant of a lack of understanding of their culture from the West. They often attribute to, they're a dumb foreigner, they don't get it. So you can get away with things that they could never, a Chinese-looking executive could never get away with. On the other hand, a Chinese executive can get away with things that you can't either, and really knowing and understanding what those are really helps you do business. But what I wanted to mention is one of the things that helped me running businesses over there, I was there with my family, and I occasionally would take my children out to our business dinners with customers. Chinese love children. Most of them only have one, if you're in the countryside, two or three children. And they also get very rare, they see lots of foreign business people, they see very few foreign children. And it was a huge
big hit
sell for me. And so they would love coming to dinner with our salesman and me and my children.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. So, you know, there are some interesting things that you can use to your advantage. My biggest customer, I went to his house one night. This is a general manager of a very large business in China, and he and I played ping pong at his house for 2 hours one night.
Yeah.
And, you know, he thought that was the greatest. I did too, actually. Thought it was one of the greatest things we ever did.
Yeah.
That guy was a very loyal customer, even as pricing was getting more and more under pressure, because we had this relationship that was totally unrelated to what were the numbers.
Did you throw the games?
No, I actually, although it's very hard to beat a Chinese person in ping pong.
True.
There is one more point, I think maybe John and Chris can comment on it. We talked about it a little bit, John mentioned it, but it's the concept of face. It's really important. It underlies all the relationships there and how you behave with people in your office. We do the same thing here in the West, in the U.S., but it's taken to an art form in China, whereas we would not scold somebody necessarily in front of their colleagues or their direct reports. There, you wouldn't even come close to that. Everything, and of course, there's this deference that says, "Welcome to my factory. I know it's really an ugly factory, and the fact is, it's a gorgeous factory." And if you don't pick up on the fact that, you know, you're supposed to say, "No, it is a gorgeous factory, and mine is not a nice factory." There's all of this interplay on making sure that you give the right amount of recognition to the other person. And if you come in from the West, you might say, "Well, good luck, you'll build up this factory later." If you said something like that, I'd be, whoa, wait, he didn't realize I have the nicest factory in the town.
Yeah.
So you do have to pick up on those clues, and they underpin every discussion in China, and you'd really need to be sensitive to that.
As a non-Chinese-speaking person, this was interesting for me. More recently, when I traveled in Asia, there was a young lady that worked for me, double E, PhD. She spoke both dialects, Mandarin and Cantonese, and she spoke Japanese. And what I found out, because she would have me sometimes do an introduction on the foils, many of the people that were in that meeting could understand English quite well, but they were self-aware, not comfortable with how they could speak it, but I was surprised how many of them understood English very well. But to do technical training, it's best to get that, you know, in their native, you know, language. So it was really interesting for a person who doesn't speak the language to find out when you're giving a PowerPoint in English and they're nodding their head, it's like, what's going on here?
Yeah, I have to just add with Craig about the face. Again, we've talked about this concept of face, and we really don't have it here in the U.S. to anywhere near the extent they do there. And it does drive a lot of their decision-making, in fact, as we mentioned earlier about even how they hire personnel. I had a mistake one time. I've lived in China for over 4 years and go back frequently, and I still have not mastered the you know what I need to do exactly, and I still make mistakes just because it's just such a foreign concept to us to always be on guard about the issue of face. I made one mistake where that investor we had for our venture in China, he had me call him Sangha, which in Chinese means third brother. Means he was the third brother in his family. So I was allowed to call him by a family name, essentially. I made the mistake of then when other people were coming to our table and I was then introducing him to others, I said, oh, this is Sangha.
For you only.
But that was a private term for me only that I was honored to use a family term. Mm-hmm. He was mad for weeks about that. And for me, I didn't even realize what I had done.
How'd you figure it out?
I figured it out once I knew that I was getting a cold shoulder. And I said, well, what did I do? And I asked my Chinese manager, who was my employee, and I said, can you help me trace the steps here? And then she said, this is what you did wrong. You know?
That's a good tip. Yeah. Having a really reliable Chinese sidekick, so to speak, really helps interpret.
Essential.
Yeah. They can prepare you. They say, now, you know, get ready. This is sort of some of the background. They can also interpret after the fact.
They won't stop it going on. The disaster is going to happen.
Because they're going to protect your face. So they won't stop it.
Because they're protecting the manager's face. Right.
But you're like, next time, why don't you protect, not protect my face and keep the problem from happening?
Right.
But you really do need an interpreter. And I'm very fluent in Chinese, but you'd have to grow up in China to really understand all the interlaced connections that are going on.
And especially when you do business outside of Shanghai or Beijing, where there's no Putonghua, the Mandarin. My business was in Chengdu, the capital of Sichuan province, and most of those people really didn't speak very good Mandarin. So even with my years spent learning Mandarin, it was in many cases useless.
Didn't work.
Right.
They might as well be speaking French.
Because they were speaking the Sichuan dialect.
I think one of the things that helped me is I spent probably as much time, maybe more, in Japan. And, you know, we're talking about the drinking and, quote, that activity for the proverbial salary man in Japan is almost a given every night. And you'll come back on the last JR that runs, and they'll all be drunk and singing, and it's just expected. But it's a release for them within that cultural, because they're so bottled up, and they do not share their emotions day-to-day with themselves or with other people. But after work, and you hit the bar, and it's like Katie bar the door. I mean, it's just an open season. And then, the next morning, hangover or not, they're back there, and it's all bottled up again. So a lot of those things with regard to the way that they react to, as Greg said, not only children but seniors, there's a tremendous respect for seniors throughout all of Asia, I think, that you don't see here. There's almost a reverence, and it doesn't mean that person is in a sense of power, but they're more deferential to senior people than what you would see here. So I think some time in Tokyo helped me also learn things that I found useful in being in China as well.
Let's shift gears just for a second. I'll give you one more thing.
One really good point that I think we should emphasize that John mentioned is, I was fairly young when I was running businesses over there, and one of the things that was very instrumental for me is somebody tipped me off very early on to turn to who was probably the oldest person in the room and say, Lao Wang, what do you think about this situation? And the very fact that I did that gained me huge amount of
cred.
Right.
Yeah, street
and,
cred.
And, you know, whether it was meaningful or helpful or useful or not, Lao Wang and everybody in the room said, this guy gets it. He's giving the right respect in the right order. And it generated a whole lot of respect for me and allowed me to get things done that would have been much harder to do. I thought that's a really good point, John.
Did it matter what that person's title was? Or how did you, somebody, you didn't know how old somebody was? Did you just guess? I mean, how did you...
Title is the other one. You kind of go to both of these two. But age, in just a social setting, around a table, age will be very important. Title, we mentioned before, they're very hierarchical. So title, you don't want to leave out the person who has the most important title.
Gotcha.
But even the person who has the most important title, if there's someone older sitting at the table from their side, from their company, they will. You'll see them make a deferential thing somewhere in the dinner to that person. And so... That age trumps title, but
just barely.
Yeah, you don't forget title.
And this is something the Chinese themselves have had to try to overcome in the sense that just as America has had young entrepreneurs start to lead fairly large companies, it's a similar situation now emerging in China where you have, you know, 20-somethings, early 30-somethings who are really amassing large companies, great wealth, and you know, they don't have that seniority, which is the old traditional Chinese view that you can't be a leader until you are senior. I mean, we see that with the Chinese government, of course, and this year is a big year as the Politburo changes out members. So you do have this transformation happening day by day.
Well, we've got about 15 minutes left, and what I want to do is transition a little bit to kind of the future of China and what you guys see as being things that they have going for them, maybe from a sourcing standpoint, you know, what the consumer side of China is starting to really unravel is the wrong word, but kind of ramp up, and also exports in that area. And we'll kind of start with just that beginning stage, and then we can get into more detail.
Well, a lot of topics there. Obviously, the big news is China's growing middle class, and of course the wealthy class, and how that is transforming their economy. Of course, domestic consumption being the big driver, the big engine, as Chinese buy more product. It's interesting. 2 weeks ago, The Economist magazine had an article where there is now the shift where there are more Chinese wanting to buy genuine product versus fake product. Now,
really?
Anyone who's lived in China knows that the fake copy of anything.
They copy anything.
They copy anything. Yeah. I mean, polo shirts, Gucci bags, you know, whatever it is. Watches. You know,
anything electronic.
Anything. Yeah. And there is now this shift where, again, because of face, we've talked about face a lot, but face even comes back into play in a person's, you know, wardrobe or what they carry on their arm. And that is starting to be a shift where the majority is buying the genuine versus the fake, or preferring if they can do so. This has been true in the automotive market, of course, where the biggest seller has been the Buick brand. Of course, BMW, Mercedes are right up there. Again, it's always because they're looking for the best. This is also true. My field here, more so with my company, is helping in the educational market. So identifying Chinese who wish to learn overseas study. Again, same thing. The Chinese, they see that the American education is the branded education. They want that for their children. And the Chinese parents and grandparents are just religious almost about their children's future. And this is another big driver of spending habits.
Are the name brands of the schools, like Princeton, a Yale, a Harvard, you know, those kinds of things, that's a pretty big deal for them?
It's extremely important for them, just as it is for us here.
Yeah.
But of course, most of us can't go there, you know, didn't have the grades or what have you, and it's true of the Chinese. So the opportunity, and this is where I sort of help to focus on, is that there are opportunities for middle-tier universities or even community colleges to offer, to showcase what they have because of their price point, their value for the price, that I think many Chinese are unaware of at this point.
I wanted to follow up on what Chris just said. I worked for a Chinese company, and one of the people there, actually, he was the president at the time, born in Taiwan, and went to good schools. His entire village collected money to be able to enable him to come to the U.S. and pursue his master's degree. He worked full-time when he was going to school, and he always sent money back home. and the money that he sent home, plus the money from that village sent the next person, and on and on and on. So when you, in your preliminary questionnaires, you know, what are some of the things that are different, and Chris hit it, the Chinese are as interested, if not more focused, on their children's education as we are in the U.S. And when you talk about long-term, not only is that short-term, I think that's the other things that you'll see about China more long-term, that education and a focus. Because if you're in Guangdong, if you're in the big major cities, you'll see an awful lot of educated people. But as Craig and I were talking about earlier, you travel out of someplace like Shanghai to Wuxi, and you'll travel for hours, and it's like looking at the U.S. in the 1950s. So many of the people in China still have a very low standard of income, but I think that standard of life. But I think one of the ways that they see to move beyond that has always been, and even more important now, and that's education for their children.
I'm going to tell a short, funny story and then hit your topic directly. But Chris made me think of it. Because virtually every problem in China is solvable with Guanxi, and the Chinese are more brand-focused than any society I have seen in the world, which actually plays well to those of us who can establish a strong brand. But they do think of Harvard or Princeton or whatever, and they are sure there must be a way for their sort of moderate student child to get in. And we're like, you know, I'm sure there is a Guanxi way in the U.S.
Can I go and buy some drinks for some people right, and hang out for a few?
It's not nearly as effective. But if I come back to your question generally, because there's a lot of sense in the U.S., especially, you know, we see the projections that China's going to overtake the U.S. by 2025. It's a financial juggernaut. I do think that it's important for us to understand some things about China generally. China is a large country with lots of challenges as well. It's becoming very nationalistic, which may pose some challenges for us in the future. But they right now have a very aging population with not a strong social structure. There is a huge discrepancy in wage earnings, much larger than the U.S. There's a large middle class, about the size of the U.S., but you take a 150, 200 million person middle class out of 1.3 billion, and you have a huge underemployment, and they're trying to continue to grow business out in the western China where many people are paid virtually nothing. So there are huge amounts of social issues inside of China that are consuming China's effort and energy and funds. So while it's right to look at every country as a competitor, I don't think we should have an irrational fear of China. China has its own challenges and has its own interests internally that have to be addressed. And every time we think of international relations, we need to sort of keep that in balance. And what would be driving this behavior?
Great.
I would just like to add, I think that the U.S. media simply misses the boat here when it comes to the concept that China is going to overtake the U.S. and be the dominant superpower. Every discussion I have, even with Chinese, educated Chinese, they're the first ones to point out to me this is nonsense, because they live day by day with the problems they have and the country has, as Craig mentioned a few there. And of course, those of us have lived there certainly understand that their challenges are more so even keeping their country together. The Communist Party is intent on maintaining authority and control as a one-party state. That'll be increasingly challenging for them. So they have far more issues internally than I think our media lets on.
Yeah, John, one of your interesting questions, I think, in their preliminary questions that you had sent out, talked about pollution. And I certainly think that was obvious for everybody during the recent Olympics. I mean, they barred traffic from driving down into Beijing. The pollution was already so bad, they did everything they could under government control, reducing electric, reducing transportation in and around the city where the games are. So, the Chinese have a lot in front of them that they're addressing in their own unique way.
But their environmental regulations, for as one who's run a business over there, are actually extremely strict. Their problem in China, and we didn't hit on this point, it would take another hour, is the ability to administer the laws that they have. Things are arbitrary throughout China, but the actual laws are very clear and they're very strict. There's a great Chinese a Chinese saying, "The heaven is high and the emperor is far," which means I'm far from Beijing, and the rules don't apply as much where I am.
Right.
And so it's very arbitrary. You could be on the suburbs of Beijing and still follow that you know.
That's right.
And so there's so much arbitrariness, but as a country, the laws are continuing to get more refined. They are getting more structured. They're trying to move towards a rule of law. And you see it in places like Shanghai, where the traffic from 15 years ago, the traffic was outrageous. I could drive on the sidewalk. I loved it. It was really fun. It was great. Now they'll give you tickets for driving on the sidewalk, and people do cross in the crosswalks, and they really are trying to make those changes, but it's 1.3 billion people scattered across a country the size of the U.S.
Yeah,
it's funny. The changes are incremental. Like having lived in Shanghai and then the Shanghai subway stations, they used to be just a madhouse getting off and on the trains, and now they've copied Hong Kong where they painted the lines at the platform, so you know where to stand and where not to stand, and they have little arrows to point. So now, again, they can paint all the lines they want to, but it may not change the behavior of the people, and that's still the problem, right?
Funny story about Shanghai and a rapid growth. This was a trip a couple of years ago, and we were out one night along the Bund, a famous place, and you see behind you on one side buildings from the French and Chinese that are almost 200 years old. Then across the river are these huge, big, you know, high rise. And I'm complimenting, you know, the Chinese on what beautiful buildings they have and how much more they've built. And he said, "We would be building more if we could get the bigger cranes, but they're all over in Dubai."
not anymore.
Yeah. But I have to also take a little exception to Craig's comment about they're trying. You know, obviously they're looking to go to more of a legal society and structure by law. But are they really? This is my question, because obviously I had a business in Chengdu that was eventually taken by the Chinese mafia at knife point, and you know we of course tried to go through legal channels, the police first, and of course the courts. There are no legal channels. Essentially, my hard experience has taught me that there's just simply, you know, there may be laws on the books, and as the expression goes, there may be laws coming out of Beijing, but again, it's not so much
heaven
of a legal society, right?
Heaven is high, and the emperor is far.
Laws are what you can make out of them. Basically,
and who's enforcing them? It's really the police, or it's the particular current local government. Isn't that a huge issue?
They have a court structure. I've run into lots of legal issues over there, both in every aspect, both business and people I knew and in individual situations. And I agree with his exception, actually. In almost every case, in the end, you're thinking, justice wasn't really done here. And part of it is we're used to a judgment of what's right and wrong, and Chinese don't solve problems that way. They compromise on everything. Say, okay, you hit me. Let's split you pay me $2,000, we're fine. It's like, wait, it was your fault. You stopped, Every one of these is a negotiated settlement, and all things behave that way. And the idea of moving from that to a judgment of, no, what's right and what's wrong by a standard,
right,
is really, really a cultural shift.
Yeah.
And in my case, I mean, there was no judgment. There was no, you know, payment at the end. They stole everything. So, in my experience, justice is simply by the amount of brute force you're able to bring into a situation.
Or guanxi.
Guanxi, or money. And money, of course, through corruption. And corruption would be a whole other topic in China.
John, I wrote down three words, and I'm not a Chinese speaker, but three things that I thought of that I can still remember that some other people that are listening might remember. Guanxi, we've talked about that one an awful lot. Two other words, Tai Chi and Feng Shui. And the Tai Chi, I can remember getting up one morning, and it was kind of like in the fall and out in a mist. And there's all these people in this little grassy place, and they're doing this Tai Chi, which is that very slow motion, you know, exercise. And you'll just see it everywhere. And it's beautiful. It's very tranquil. It's been there for years, and it's meditation. It isn't primarily based on or anything to do with martial arts. And the other one that was funny that I learned about, I'm probably not pronouncing it right, Feng Shui, where they hire these people, and these people figure out, does this capture or allow the, I don't know, mystical relationships?
The energy.
The energy, the energy and the life force. Funny story, in Hong Kong, the Peninsula Hotel, very famous old hotel, used to have an unobstructed view of Kowloon Bay, I guess.
Hong Kong Island.
Hong Kong Island, all that. And somebody built in front of them, of course, really ticked off. What happened was they had to make some changes because this Feng Shui guy came in, and the answer was there was a brick wall facing the water, and the guy's answer was, you've got to tear out that brick wall, and you've got to put in glass because the dragon can't get out to the water. But the dragon can get through the glass, but it can't get through the brick wall. It's like, wow. It's only places in Asia would you hear these kind of things. But you'll see it sometimes in the U.S. where they'll actually hire one of these experts, and they'll check out the energy and maybe relocate the way that the building is pointed. Three things that stuck with me and still do.
Oh, yeah. The architect that I hired to build our nightclub, yeah, the placement of the door was... Feng shui was an important consideration.
Yeah. Well, we're wrapping up on time here, so we're going to do one last thing with each person, and that is to get your pearl of wisdom. And let's maybe direct this towards our listeners that maybe haven't had experience in China, but maybe would like to go that route. Chris, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I again always say that American companies are missing out if they're not in China. You need to be in China, whether you're selling a service, a professional service, or obviously products, or if you are intending to source products. Now, of course, sourcing is moving more to Vietnam, but that's another subject. Mm-hmm. There's huge advantages there. We've talked a lot about the problems and the cultural differences, but you can overcome them, and if you hire the right people, then wink, wink, nudge, nudge, nudge. But you can overcome these things and get into the market.
So, contact information for you, somebody who may want to hire the right company. What's the best way to get in contact with you?
Well, my firm is simply named Our Team in China, and we have a website at ourteaminchina.com, and that will direct you to my story and our services.
Okay. Well, thank you much for coming on the show. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Craig?
Mine will go a different direction, but I think on a one-on-one basis, as we find everywhere in the world, the Chinese people are absolutely beautiful, very kind and very generous. And we deal with them in business environments, and business can be very frustrating, very challenging, and times that consumes and creates our view. But in fact, as you have lots of opportunities to travel through the countryside and talk to the average person and see the delight in people who are not making very much money and happy to be of service, happy to learn, happy to engage, I think we shouldn't miss that. It's a beautiful country with beautiful people, and I think everybody should try to experience that.
Well put, well put. If somebody wanted to reach out and had questions for you, is there an easy way to get in contact?
Best way to get me would be to find me on LinkedIn, Craig Belknap.
All right. And spell that last name.
Belnap.
Okay. Thank you much. John?
Yeah, I think that traveling out of the U.S. to any country, you're best served to find somebody that understands the culture and the nuances and spend some time with them and or reading on your own. And then the last step is when you get there, hopefully you've got a Chinese-speaking national to help you in the instances that both Craig and Chris have talked about, and listen to them, value what they say, plan on whatever your time frame is, double it or triple it or quadruple it, and plan on being there, not only you, but you and your people for a long term. And that would be my suggestion. And the easiest way to get in touch with me would be on my website, and that's CorbettAssociates.com, and Corbett is CORBITT, Associates.com. Thank you again, John.
Okay. Well, appreciate all your time this morning. A great conversation, as I expected it to be. To our listeners, we appreciate your time as well. Hopefully you gained some insight as to doing business in China. And until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.